The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Well, there goes the Daverhood. Welcome, everybody, to Dave's Gone By, an hour of comedy, talk radio, and music on this Thursday, October 7th, 2004. We join you every week on WGBB AM 1240 and live streaming on AM 1240 WGBB.com. Thanks to Total Theater, publishers of Performing Arts Insider Magazine, Quiznos of Hewlett, Tasty Soups and Snacks and Sandwiches, and Hewlett Minuteman Press for all your photocopying and printing needs. Ah, the generosity of our sponsors. And we're on every Thursday night, 7 to 8 p.m., thanks to the listenerosity of you, our loyal and adorable audience. Ladies and gentlemen, this is our 96th episode, counting up to the big 100 just a month from now. In fact, tonight is our second anniversary show, or more precisely, the beginning of our third year on the air. Dave's Gone By started on October 6th, 2002, as a late-night program on Sundays. Basically, we had three total listeners, and two of them were imaginary. But the station believed in the show, saw that I was trying to make radio that was a little different, a little unique, loose, but professional, funny, but serious, 60 minutes, but 57 minutes because of commercials, and very soon, we were moved to earlier on Sunday nights, where we started to build a following. 10 listeners, only 5 of them imaginary. That led to a primetime weeknight slot, first on Mondays, and for the past bunch of months, here we are, Thursday night, 7 o'clock, with an hour of smart talk, silly talk, special talk, and music. We've had a lot of special guests on recently, including cabaret singer Dottie Berman, and comic actress Andrea Kolb, jazz pop musicians Jeff Labus and Dustin Ehrlich, and of course our extended interview with folk music legend Tom Paxton. And tonight, another major get, as we say in the Marconi biz. A good get is someone really cool, someone you've always wanted to talk to, or someone who maybe doesn't do a lot of press but chooses to appear on your program, or just someone who, when you tell people, hey, so-and-so is going to be a guest on my show, they go, wow, that's really excellent, I'm going to tune in. So, everyone who's tuned in tonight, you're in for a treat, my get. Now, let me preface this by saying, I've had a lot of influences in my career and my artistic life and just my daily life. Lots of musicians and writers and actors and directors I admire and have tried to emulate in some fashion. And then there are the Pantheon. Some folks who are so high, so godlike in the temple of my consciousness that I just genuflect. I give thanks that I was alive to see their work, to experience these mind-blowing, life-changing talents, usually from a perspective that is so individual, so revolutionary, so I'm doing my own thing and the world will catch up to me, uncommon, that you feel embarrassed any time your own work conforms or compromises to something less. So, people in this pantheon for me would range from Charlie Chaplin when I was younger to Woody Allen to Kurt Vonnegut and a bunch of people musically, but way up at the tippy top are two groups, both from England. One, of course, the Beatles, who were music for me from the time I was like 5 all through my teen years. And on the comedy side of things, Monty Python's Flying Circus. I remember my dad watching that on Sunday nights just as I was heading off to sleep before school the next day. And eventually they let me stay up and watch it because it was so different and so bizarre. And my dad was laughing his head off. I was laughing my head off. So, Beatles and Python. And I'm certainly not alone in people who grew up in the 60s and 70s and found those two anarchic, ingenious groups the psychic cornerstones of delight, humor, and music. And since they were nearly of the same era, Python started the year the Beatles broke up, there was some interplay between the two. The Beatles, influenced by the music hall and the Goon Show, brought comedy to their music and press conferences and their movies. The pythons, young men during the British invasion, were often musical in the cadence of their dialogue, or they added comic numbers to their sketches, like Eric the Half a Bee or the Lumberjack song. And there were some mutual friendships between the Beagles and pythons that even went beyond an admiration society. If it weren't for George Harrison's handmade films, we wouldn't have the life of Brian. And nearly all the pythons were there to do the Lumberjack song at the concert for George, honoring him after he died. So these two groups were kindred spirits, tour guides on the same magical mystery tour. And one man was connected to both. One man had a songwriting credit with John Lennon and Paul McCartney, however spurious, and a song produced by Paul McCartney. And the same man shared screen time with John Cleese, Eric Idle, Michael Palin, Terry Jones, Terry Gilliam, and Graham Chapman. In fact, this man and Carol Cleveland have both shared the sacred title of the Seventh Python. I wish I had an echo on this. Maybe more like, the Seventh Python. And this man was essentially a full-fledged member in that last TV season after Cleese left. He was on tour with them, singing two songs captured on their Live at Drury Lane album. And if you haven't guessed by now, I'm talking, of course, about Neil Innes, who has spent the years since Python making music, doing concerts, painting, doing other television series, and essentially following his own vision as a musical and amusing comic artist. Neil Innes is my guest tonight in the neighborhood. So if you loved Python or the Beatles or the Ruggles, stay tuned. We also have the news gone by, a comic look at world and local events, a la Weekend Update, Le Show and Le Daily Show, and Inside Broadway, our weekly peek at New York theater. Tonight's topic is Bryony Lavery, the author of that fine show from last season, Frozen. Well, Lavery has a new comedy opening off-Broadway, and some offstage drama in her life as well. So don't miss Inside Broadway, brought to you by Performing Arts Insider. And the rest of Dave's Gone By, brought to you by me, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, theater critic, journalist, and humorist, reminding parents listening that Dave's Gone By is rated DGB-13. That's kind of like PG-13, only with a D and a B instead of a P. And if you have to take a P, do it now, because you don't want to miss the rest of the show. Broadway, funny news, and Neil Innes all coming at you in just a minute, right after this. I've been telling you for months why you should use Hewlett Minuteman Press for all your copying and printing needs. But here's one of the owners, Mike Toron, to tell you why.
Hi, how you doing? At Minuteman Press, our ultimate goal is service. We are your best source for the most complete line of printed products. You can check us out on the web at www.hewlett.minutemanpress.com.
My radio's on, the news is all bad, but it's good for a laugh.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. On this Thursday, October 7th, 2004, it's time for the news gone by, a look at events of the past week from an inescapable perspective. In political news, Governor of New Jersey Jim McGreevy says he has no regrets about stepping down from his job or staying in it till the next election, despite the fallout from his patronage scandal and public admission of his homosexuality. McGreevy said he looks forward to remaining a political advocate for his home state. He told the Daily News, quote, "I have a love affair with the state of New Jersey," unquote. His opponent then added, "Of course he does. New Jersey smells like ass." Hey, here's something I bet you didn't know. A survey by the nonprofit organization Families USA shows that premiums for health insurance for workers have risen 3 times faster than their wages. No. You're kidding. A study also found that benefits are being cut, while at the same time coverage prices are increasing. I don't know. They must be making this stuff up. But seriously, the scariest numbers show that during the one-year period of the study, 85 million people, that's one out of every 3 Americans under the age of 65, went without health coverage for some period of time. I guess there's only one word to describe the state of health care in America right now: sick. Also in health news, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who has long been a fan and proponent of cigars, has signed a bill that bars tobacco from state prisons. Hypocritical, maybe, but also healthy, the absence of smokes from the prison population is expected to save millions in health care costs, especially since half the incarcerated population of California currently smokes. The ban is not expected to cause jailhouse riots, although the black market price of carrots, celery, and pretzel rods has gone through the roof. In world news, a 17-year-old man in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, is being held by police for shooting his wife, who was picking fruit out of a tree behind their house. His defense is that he mistook her for a monkey. In related news, friends and relatives of O.J. Simpson's latest girlfriend have been warning her to shave regularly and never eat a banana in his presence. Speaking of Malaysia, congratulations to Nur Malena Hassan, the Scorpion Queen, for setting a new world's record last week. She spent 36 days in a 120-square-foot glass box crawling with 6,000 live scorpions. It all took place in a shopping mall where Hassan was allowed to leave the box for just 15 minutes daily to use the bathroom. Yes, she was stung several times, but she says she doesn't mind being crawled over by scorpions because she's a Libra. In other venomous predator news, a movie theater in Houston had to be shut down last week because a janitor spotted an 8-foot-long snake slithering in front of the screen. Ironically, the movie being shown was Anacondas, swear to God, but the sighting was apparently no joke or hallucination. Experts have been called in to find and trap what they believe is a Burmese python. The irony here is that this is the first time in the history of cinema that a girl reached into the box of popcorn in her boyfriend's lap and really did feel sick. A little tidbit for history buffs. Researchers now believe that World War I flying ace Manfred von Richthofen, better known as the Red Baron, went into an emotional tailspin after being shot in the head. The brain injury changed his formerly outgoing personality and caused him to fixate on things. In fact, one of his journals makes daily references to his being fired upon by a small, cute, black-and-white dog. Speaking of which, we get one of these stories every few weeks. Hunting accident. It happened to even the most experienced sportsman, among them Spazo Ivosevich. That's his name, Spazo. And old Spaz had loaded and cleaned his double-barreled shotgun, just as he's been doing since 1957. The Croatian hunter leaned his weapon behind his house when, according to the Associated Press, his 2-year-old dog, Lero, came barreling through the yard chasing the chickens. Lero bumped into the shotgun, which fell to the ground and fired, showering Spazo with pellets. The poor fellow suffered a leg fracture. Asked if he'd give up the sport of kings after this, Spazo said, "Yes, I'm done. I'm just going to have one more hunt." He wasn't specific about his plans, although the AP reporter did notice Lero had a target painted on his muzzle. And speaking of dangerous dogs in Eastern Europe, certainly one of my favorite topics, if you're Constantine Mocanu of Bucharest, Romania, you're a danger to yourself, let alone having to worry about your pet. Mocanu was having trouble sleeping because of a noisy chicken that was squawking in his yard at night. So the 67-year-old man rushed out into the yard in his underwear to kill the offending bird. He was brandishing a sharp knife with which to hack off the chicken's neck. Somehow, and Reuters is not clear on this, but somehow, Mocanu got confused. Instead of chopping the chicken, he cut off his own penis. Said Mocanu, quote, "I confused it with the chicken's neck, I cut it," unquote. And to add insult to injury, Mocanu's dog, who apparently didn't do a damn thing about the squawking chicken, suddenly woke up, rushed into the yard, and ate Mocanu's severed penis. I guess he was a wiener dog. No, but the poor bastard was rushed to the hospital, bleeding heavily, but stabilized and out of danger. Still, this serves as a safety lesson for all of us. Remember, folks, if you start choking your chicken and it doesn't squawk, you probably have the wrong cock. And that's the news gone by for October 7th, 2004. Please send your comments, opinions, and black market roll goals to Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. Dave's Gone By, Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. You can also email me, davesgoneby@aol.com, or learn more about the show at davesgoneby.com. We have CDs of past programs for sale, photographs of Dave, that's me, a page of guest links, and much more. davesgoneby.com. We reserve the right to read your comments on the air, name withheld upon request, so send me your thoughts, your gifts, your free product samples, but please, no scorpions. The last thing we need is a second invasion of Arachnids. Back with Inside Broadway after this.
And that was news, yes, that was news. That was very, very, very special news.
These are the days of the endless summer.
Wait, did he just say these are the Daves?
These are the days.
He did. Van Morrison is singing about Dave's Gone By and the CDs we have of the show. Dozens of complete episodes available on cassette and CD. $14 a piece for CDs, $12 for cassettes, and cheaper if you buy more. Go to davesgoneby.com and get these precious presents today. Inside Broadway, brought to you by Total Theater's Performing Arts Insider, your everything theater guide. A sleeper of the past Broadway season was the stark, gripping drama Frozen by English playwright Brioni Lavery. Brian O'Byrne played a pathological serial killer of children, luring them off playgrounds into his van, and eventually to their deaths. Staged at Circle in the Square with just three actors, Frozen grabbed you with its frankness and psychological insight. Well, turns out that insight might not be 100% Lavery's. Two writers have now accused her of stealing entire passages and detail-filled incidents from the book Guilty by Reason of Insanity and from a New Yorker article about the writer of that book. Lawyers are now trying to hammer out a deal between Lavery and the other writers, whose nonfiction look at criminal pathology she turned into a play. Although not quite a financial hit, Frozen was well-received and Tony-nominated, losing to Doug Wright's I Am My Own Wife. No doubt, Lavery wants to get this plagiarism charge settled quickly, as she has another play opening in New York tonight, October 7th. It's called Last Easter, and it sounds like a very different and lighter play. In it, a woman is diagnosed with cancer, so her three friends take her on a whirlwind trip to France, with lots of drinking, camaraderie, and sharing of secrets, of course. The show is produced by Manhattan Class Company, the same folks who did Frozen, with the same director, Doug Hughes. Starring in the play are Clea Lewis, who was a regular on Ellen, the sitcom Ellen DeGeneres had before her hit talk show, and Vianne Cox, last seen as the tightly wound mom in Caroline or Change. For tickets to Last Easter, playing at the Lucille Lortel Theater on Christopher Street, call 212-279-4200. Will Easter be a colorful addition to the season? Or will it lay an egg? The best way to find out is by subscribing to Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. It's Broadway. It's off-Broadway. Cabaret, dance, opera. If it's on stage in New York, Performing Arts Insider has it. 50 pages every month available by subscription from Total Theater, with Dave's Gone By listeners getting 10% off. Call 516-295-1511 or email paipress@aol.com. Subscriptions are expensive, but worth every penny. And if you just want to check out the current issue to see if it's for you, No problem. Call 516-295-1511 and order it for $10, nearly a third off the cover price. No theater lover should be without it, Performing Arts Insider. Hey, we've been talking about a lot of new shows recently, but tonight, two shows are opening from the old school, and I mean the really old school, ancient Greece. At 45 Bleecker, a venue located conveniently enough at 45 Bleecker Street, they're offering Hecuba. It's a tragedy about a queen who loses most of her children in war, and when her last one gets killed, her youngest, she commits a Medea-level act of violence. This is a straightforward production featuring veteran actress and voice teacher Kristen Linklater and soap opera actress Heather Tom. She was on Broadway last year in Primate. Yes, that's the one where she was humped, urinated on, and molested by a gorilla. Well, an actor playing a gorilla, anyway. What people do for art. And another ancient wartime play opening tonight at Theater 3, a company called Freshly Squeezed Creative Juices. They're doing an adaptation of The Acharnians. It's an Aristophanes comedy from 425 BC. Now, we're taking some liberties with the story, modernizing it, specifically for its political relevance. The story tells of a country at war, but one city signs its own personal peace treaty with the enemy. Should be fun. So that's Acharnians at Theater 3 on West 43rd Street, now through October 24th. For more on all these shows and hundreds of other productions all around New York, Performing Arts Insider is the place to go. And the place to be next week is here for more theater news, including a milestone for Golda's Balcony and a reckless return to Broadway for Mary Louise Parker. That and more Inside Broadway. We've just been Inside Broadway with Total Theater and Performing Arts Insider.
Oh, honey, you turn me on, and the radio.
That's right, Joni. I turn you on all week long for a bunch of shows on WGBB, like Wednesday nights at 11 for psychic astrologer Joyce Keller, hosting radio's longest-running psychic advice show. She knew I'd say that. Thursday nights at 6, an hour before Dave's gone by, it's WGBB Tonight with Larry Davidson. And then, right after my show, Smooth Jazz, The Instrumental Invasion with Mike Shimeri at 8. Friday nights at 6, Bonnie D. Graham has advice about being single and singular on Long Island's dating. And things get wilder on the weekends with the Saturday Night Rock Block, starting at 7:30 with the Mr. Redman Music Show, up-and-coming Long Island rock bands, and a weekly countdown, followed by Mikey and Jimmy. It's a madhouse. It's a zoo. It's Mikey and Jimmy, Saturday nights at 9. And then, on Sundays at 7, Joe Salzone offers conservative politics with a sense of humor and an open mind on your world.
If you're driving into town with the dark cloud of funny looks,
dial in AM 1240 WGBB for Joyce Keller Wednesday nights at 11, Larry Davidson Thursdays at 6, yours truly at 7, Mike Shimeri Thursdays at 8, Bonnie D. Graham Fridays at 6, The Rock Block Saturdays from 7:30 to 10, and Joe Salzone Sundays at 7.
Call me at the station, the lights are up.
Be an idiot, as harmless as a cloud, too small to hide the sun, almost poking fun at the warm but insecure, untidy crowd. How sweet to be an idiot, and if my brain enjoys children laughing at my back with no fear of attack, as much retaliation as a toy. How sweet to be an idiot.
how sweet.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. And I'm here with a very, 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 very special guest on the phone with us. I can say three different bands, or groups, I should say, and this man was connected to them all. He was somewhat, interestingly, and we'll hear about it, connected with the Beatles, also connected with Monty Python's Flying Circus, and then quite directly connected with a band called The Ruttles. I am, of course, talking about Neil Innes, who's on the phone with us from his home in England. Welcome, Neil.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm good. I'm sorry about having to go with the obvious intro stuff and not saying, oh, yes, he's been a musician for 40 years, and he's done Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, and he's got this CD out, you know.
Yeah, Mel Brooks used to say, you forgot the ice hockey.
Well, did you do ice hockey?
Neither did he. But
well, what was your childhood like? Let's start right there.
Oh, let's go back to your childhood.
Yeah, lie on the couch and tell us all.
Well, I suppose I was born at the end of the Second World War, 1944, which I don't remember anything much about, but I'm told that a flying bomb was actually sort of instrumental in speeding things up.
Oh, good God, yeah. So your mom's labor was like 4 minutes or something? We're going to get 3 hours and then suddenly
a bomb? They used to have these flying bombs that people could hear, and when the engine stopped, you just ran for cover because it meant it was going to come down somewhere.
Oh, my gosh.
Quickly moving on, I mean, I was a sort of toddler, then we moved to Germany because my father was in the army. And I spent about 5 or 6 years in Germany as a child and left when I was about 11 or 12.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memories of
before? Oh, really loads, yes. I mean, my father was sufficiently well-connected to sort of pull a few strings and got us in a place called Bad Harzburg, which was a ski resort.
Mm-hmm.
And a very beautiful place to live. And so, in fact, when I came back to England when I aged about 12, you know, I was rather surprised to see how primitive England still was, because we were living in rather nice houses with central heating and things.
And there's that moment at the end of one of the Monty Python episodes where it almost comes out of a still World War II photograph, and you're saying, when does a dream begin?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it was Maggie Gilliam. That was Terry Gilliam's wife.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll get to the Python stuff later.
Yeah.
I just had to bring that up, but it just seems connected, I guess, in some
subconscious
way.
Well, I suppose my generation is, you know, because part of the thing about growing up later on is, you know, people 2 or 3 years older than me were drafted.
Oh.
But I missed it all, and so I became part of that sort of swinging London scene, you know, where the people, you know, could go to university and they didn't have to go into the forces.
Did you go to art school as so many?
Yeah, I went to art school.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was going to say about Germany, sure. When I first started learning the piano, I had a German piano teacher who was, you know, very, very soft-spoken and kind, you know, because I suppose, when he said the day came I had to do something different with my left hand to my right hand, I declared it was impossible, you see, I was only 7.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I don't think so, you know, because look at me, my left hand can do something different.
I commanded all of Germany with just my right hand. No,
yeah, exactly.
No,
so I said, oh, well, you know, sort of, I'm wrong, you know, so that, but that kicked me into sort of like, you know, taking it up. But, when I was about 14, you know, I was playing Chopin and all this kind of stuff. Hormones. They must have kicked in or something, because I became very anti, and I thought, who am I working for? You know, because every time I finish a piece, they give me a harder one. So that's when I picked up a guitar and sort of taught myself to play a guitar. But then I got more interested in painting, and so that's what I did. I left school and went to art school in London.
And then through that, how did it suddenly work towards television and music and, you know, back to that other way?
Yeah, well, exactly. As an art student, you know, we had to sort of spend money on paint and things. It was quite expensive, so everyone was sort of always poor. Students are always poor.
Oh, yeah.
And so this is where the Bonzos came in. You know, they'd already got the name and they were already playing this kind of dreadful, you know, sort of 20s and 30s kind of jazz up at the Royal College of Art in their canteen.
and they needed a pianist, and so I came along, and I thought, well, this is a bit of a hoot. And then, I don't know, because we had to go so far, you know, I was living in South London, we had to go all the way up to Kensington. Vernon Dudley Bohay Noel, the banjo player, and I, we found a big pub with a big room, and they said we could play in there.
Mm-hmm.
So we started passing the hat round, and it became very successful, and it built up to us playing in about 5 different pubs a week. And we, about 9 of us were earning, you know, very good money.
Were you writing your own songs at that point?
No,
just
we
covers?
Were.
Okay.
Well, we got all our songs from old records, you know, the old 78s,
mm-hmm.
you know, the breakable ones. And we didn't know what they were like, obviously, because you had to go just by the labels. And if it said Novelty Foxtrot, or if it had a silly title like I'm Going to Bring a Watermelon to My Girl Tonight, you bought it.
Right.
You know, for a penny or tuppence, you know. And got home, and maybe, you know, maybe 3 out of a dozen might be worth it. And so we'd, you know, sort of put it to the rest of the band, and we'd learn them if we liked them.
Was the sound rock or skiffle or pop?
No, it was sort of 20s and 30s silly jazz.
The records you were playing, but also you were emulating that sound, too.
Yeah, I mean, this is what worked in the pubs, you know. There was an awful lot of jazz in the pubs in those days, even though, you know, the Beatles were just about starting. The instruments were cheap, you know, you could buy trumpets and bits and pieces, and even if you couldn't play them, it was a good idea to make a funny row with it. And of course, very visual gags we used to do as well.
Initially, it was the Bonzo Dog Dada band from the Dada art movement, but then you said you changed it because...
Well, you couldn't, you know, have you ever tried explaining what the turn of the century anti-art movement is to someone who hasn't heard of it? You know, you can't really do it in a quick way.
What was that? Yeah.
We just said, well, never mind, we'll just call it Doodah.
Was Bonzo Dog, though, the first name, or did you think spend
time? All of it, it came out of the hat.
Oh, really?
Vivian Stanshall and Rodney Slater, I think, were responsible for the name. And they just put Bonzo Dog as an image, if you like, into the hat, because Bonzo Dog was a, you know, very popular sort of cartoon character here.
Right.
But I also believe it was, you know, syndicated in America, too, and Band and Dada and some other things, you know, but Bonzo Dog and Dada and Band came out, so that's how it started.
And did it become visual quickly, or was it mostly musical?
No, it was definitely not musical, it was mostly visual. Well, this is the extraordinary thing, you know, because, I mean, there was a lot of enthusiasm and things like that, but to see a bunch of, you know, people with wing collars and two-tone shoes and frock coats and Union Jacks and sort of pith helmets, you know, jungle helmets and this kind of thing. It was quite a jolly thing. It took the attention away from how poor the playing was.
Well, you must have actually been pretty proficient on the guitar, or were you back to keyboards?
No, I was only playing keyboards then.
Right.
And of course, you know, anybody who's played piano in a band has this kind of, I don't know, sort of slumped shoulders until you actually get to wherever you're going to play, and then if you find out it's got a good piano, you cheer up, and if it's got a bad piano, you get depressed. But, in fact, we did one, not the Bonzos, I was playing with someone else, and the piano was just so bad that at the end of the evening, I just took it all to bits. I took every key out, every bit I could disassemble, and I left it in a heap.
Well, there's that famous, that magnificent scene from one of the later Marx Brothers films, where it's Harpo playing, I believe.
Oh, yes, that's right. He takes the piano to bits and plays the frame like a harp.
It almost explodes on him. It's just coming apart while he's playing it, which is a magnificent thing to see.
Yeah.
So, you know, playing in this hall rather successfully that you folks all sort of got together and cobbled together and became a regular gig.
That's right. There were 9 of us when we first went off on our... No, 8 of us. There were 8 of us. I mean, we did in my last year at the art school, we'd become such a success in the pubs that we got offered this sort of job in a sort of like, well, how would you call it? Kind of cabaret nightclubs in the north of England, and we did a week, and it was so successful that they booked us back for 6 weeks when we finished college.
Huh.
So it all seemed quite a good idea at the time. And So anyway, off we went and started doing these things after we'd finished college. But then, to sort of, you know, explain how we sort of changed and modified from this kind of rather raucous and silly, you know, outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Doing anything. Our trumpeter at that time, this is about our third or fourth trumpeter, was called Bob Kerr. And he knew a man called Jeff Stevens, who'd put together a band of session men to mm-hmm. make Winchester Cathedral.
Oh, gosh.
And called it the New Vaudeville Band.
Uh-huh.
So he hadn't got a band to go out and promote the hit. So he rang Bob Kerr, the trumpeter, and asked Bob to ask us if we'd like to become the New Vaudeville Band. And, of course, we all said no, you know. But he said, well, you know, why not? We've got a hit. We could go on Top of the Pops and things like that. And he said, well, I'm going to do it. And so we said, well, off you go. You know, never darken our towers again. And but the downside was, the very next thing you see on television on the Top of the Pops program is this new vaudeville band that they put together looking exactly like we looked, with the sort of like,
oh, they stole
gangster suits and two-tone shoes, big ties. They even copied the jokes of, you know, like comic speaking balloons. We used to make them out of sort of cardboard and paint them and hold them up above people's heads so it looked like a comic. And they were even doing that. And the singer had a sort of a gold lamé suit. And of course, everywhere we went, everyone said, oh, you're like that new vaudeville band.
Oh, boy.
So, that's when we realized we were suddenly in show business.
Well, you guys could change your looks all the time. No? I mean, your whole point was visual, so...
Yeah,
why
well,
just...
you know, we just suddenly said, well, hang on, this is, you know, we can do anything we want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can play any kind of music we want. And so that's when we started writing our own stuff.
Okay.
So in many ways, it was a kind of a good thing.
What was your first song?
Mine was pretty much Equestrian Statues, my first one, I think.
And then how long between the point when you changed the whole sound of the band or what you guys were doing to the first step of quote-unquote pop success?
Right. I suppose a couple of years, because there we were playing all this silly stuff, and we'd recorded with EMI.
Mm-hmm.
At Abbey Road, we'd recorded our first single, which is called My Brother Makes the Noises for the Talkies, which is exactly where it, you know, it came from, one of those old 78s.
Right.
And funnily enough, it was at the same time that the Beatles were in there. Well, we were in Abbey Road and recording this silly thing, My Brother Makes the Noises for the Talkies, you know, sort of this ship's noises, you know, guns and bangs and whatever, all these kind of things. And I'd been to the gents, I think, down the corridor, and I was coming back, and I saw in the doorway, you know, these four guys with sort of distinctive haircuts and pointy shoes and dark glasses with a couple of big blokes standing by them. And I went, oh, wow, it's the Fabs, it's the Beatles, you know, of course, they record here too. And so I snuck out a bit later on to sort of, like, listen to what they were doing, and I heard them, and they were doing I Want to Tell You.
Right, yeah,
with that fantastic piano part going da 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 da, and I thought, oh wow, this is really good. Years later, I was staying with George in the kitchen, and I was telling him about, you know, in the show I sometimes tell that story, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he said, there's a piano just outside the kitchen, and I started playing it, you know, and he picked up a guitar, and God knows the last time he'd played it, but he played that riff, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, you know, straight away, perfectly, didn't have to think what it was. And So that was, you know, that was quite a nice moment. But, I mean, the thing was, they were doing that at that time. When was it, 64 or something?
That was a little later for them. That was probably about 65, 66.
Something like that, maybe. No, 66 it must have been. And we were making this sort of silly old 30s jazz. So, but by the time we put out our first album called Gorilla, we'd moved on and to writing our own stuff. And yes, Equestrian Statue I'd written as music for the Head Ballet, and mm-hmm. Piggy Bank Love, all these kind of, and it was a gentle poke at the pop business, you know.
And then, sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, but, and then the second album, we got even more adventurous and went more psychedelic. But because the 60s were good fun, you know, I mean, I don't remember a lot about them, because, you know, they say if you can remember them, you weren't there. But
you guys didn't, I mean, did you indulge the way 60s bands indulged, or were you pretty much, you were art students who were more straight? I mean, you probably drank a little, but, or were you really out there? I mean, did you
no,
guys?
No, we weren't really out there, no. As we told a sheriff's officer in Buffalo, who sort of asked us if we'd got any pot, whatever. So we said, no, we're pint of beer men, you know, sort of warm beer from England. But no, it was, certainly wasn't any sort of like mazed acid trips or anything within the band. I think everyone had enough of an imagination to sort of, without sort of pushing the envelope, as it were.
And of course, we do have to get to the story of the Urban Spaceman, which is
indeed.
The first thing people probably know you guys for.
Yeah.
So
we were doing a television series called Do Not Adjust Your Set with pre-Monty Pythons, Eric Idle, Michael Palin, Terry Jones, and Terry Gilliam. And Gorilla has been a reasonable success, and they wanted a single. They were desperate for a single, and we didn't see ourselves as in the kind of regular pop music machine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We saw ourselves as sort of, as one witty journalist called us, the clown princes of pop. But so we didn't really want to make a single. In any case, we had a manager who was also our record producer. And he used to say after, you know, 3 hours, he said, that's it, time's up, time to move on to the next one. And of course, some of the things we wanted to do were quite time consuming and involved, you know.
And you have four tracks back in.
And we only had four tracks. Yes, right. We did the anybody's heard the intro and the outro, that was done on four tracks, believe it or not. You know, we'd record one thing and then another one, and then we'd bounce it down to another one, just bouncing it around the four tracks, and built it up into this, you know, extraordinary thing with all those people on it.
Right.
But, yeah, so Biff used to hang out a lot with both John Lennon and Paul McCartney, and one evening he was in a club with Paul, moaning about this manager, producer, who wouldn't let us finish our ideas. And so now we've got this bloody single to make and whatnot. And so Paul just offered, and he said, well, I'll come and produce it if you like. And
he meant it.
He meant it. And so it was wonderful to be able to go to this manager producer bloke and say, well, actually, we don't want you to produce the single. And him saying, oh, and who do you think you're going to get then? Pause, you know.
Let him stew for a minute. And then.
Yeah, exactly. Or a minute and a half. Yeah. So anyway, Paul came on the day and was absolutely magical and turned the whole thing around, and it took over 8.5 hours.
And were they a lesson? I mean, did you just sort of learn a million things, or were you too into it, just doing the song over and over and over? And
no, actually, well, I mean, I did learn a thing or two, you know, because he said, your job, you know, well, never mind what we're doing, the thing, you keep singing it. You keep singing it in. But the thing was, right early on when he sort of turned up, we'd already met because we'd done Magical Mystery Tour and all this kind of thing.
Oh, okay. Maybe we should backtrack on that. How did you wind up in that? Was it a BBC just mutual thing?
Paul's brother Michael was in a comedy group called The Scaffold, and we kept bumping into them, saw quite a lot of them. And I think Mike turned Paul onto the Bonzos, but as it turned out, Paul had already been to see us, you know, they'd all been to see us in the days when they used to put on false beards. of course it was kind of thing, it was like a reminder, and I think Paul was just sort of throwing it together in many ways, and the strip club scene was in there, so we thought we'd be perfect for the strip club scene.
And
so so Paul turns up in the recording studio and says, "How are you?" and all this kind of thing. And he hops on the piano. He says, I've just written this." And he starts playing "Hey Jude."
Oh, jeez.
But nobody's heard it. You know, no, it's never been. The Beatles haven't probably heard it yet. And I just think he's taking the mickey out of the producer. Because it goes on and on and on, you know. And,
I'm sure the first time you heard it, it's like, okay, it's a good 4-minute song. Why is he still playing it?
Yeah, but I mean, I'll put my hand up as well. When you first write a song, you keep playing it over and over and over. You know, it helps bed it in, you know. I thought it was hysterical. There he's playing. I said, what is dirge he's playing?
Oh, my gosh.
So he double-tracked the drums. I mean, he picked up Viv Stanshall's ukulele, and even though he's left-handed. Well, actually, no, so Viv. But he was playing that. And, in fact, our manager and producer had a very, very posh sort of wife, a very big lady with huge tracts of love.
yes, all Monty Python fans get that reference, yes.
But she'd been to Oxford and things like that, and she had a very, very English voice. And she'd never been to one of our recordings before, but because Paul was there, she sort of decided she would attend.
Sure.
And so Paul starts plunking the ukulele, and she plucks up courage and comes up and says, "Oh, what's that you've got there? A poor man's violin?"
Uh-huh.
And Paul very immediately said, "No, it's a rich man's ukulele."
And did you, at that point, establish, on some level, because you ended up knowing George pretty well, but a relationship with three or four or some of the Beatles in the years ahead that was really a friendship, in a way?
Well, certainly with George. I mean, I found John rather terrifying. We went to a Christmas party at Apple in Savile Row, and my son was about three, I think, and they had a room where they had a sort of Father Christmas and a conjurer, but it was at a time when all the Hell's Angels were there as well. And all of a sudden, my son's missing. So I start looking around for him, and I find him in another room, sat on a Hell's Angel's knee, who's sort of like feeding him beer from a can with his finger.
Right.
So I said, "Oh, there you are. Yeah, so come on, there's a conjurer," you know, things like that. And then I noticed that John and Yoko were sort of sat on the floor in the corner. And John says, "Hello, how are you?" And I said, "Fine, yes, fine," you know. But I was more concerned about getting my son out of the clutches of the Hell's Angels.
We were feeding them beer, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I didn't hang out with him in that case.
Or even in the later years when he became, you know, he got out.
It wasn't long after that they sort of, like, you know, packed up.
I'd like to propose a toast.
Big deal. I'd like to propose a toasty, a tasty toasty sub sandwich from Quiznos, like spicy Monterey Club, mesquite chicken, or smoked turkey on rosemary parmesan bread, all made with quality ingredients like freshly sliced premium meats, crisp vegetables, and rich melted cheeses. And the bread, oven-toasted artisan bread the old-fashioned way.
I'll drink to that.
At Quiznos, you can sip a soft drink or one of their flavorful hearty soups. They've also got desserts and snacks, or you can keep an eye on carbs with toasty flatbreads and fresh, craveable salads like Roadhouse Ranch and Yin Yang Chicken.
Aren't they the best?
They sure are. Quiznos, now with a new store in Hewlett, Long Island, 1320 Broadway. Mention Dave's Gone By and get 10% off your meal. I'll drink to that.
Everybody rise! Rise! Rise!
If you're a good American, that means you like to own things. Well, now's your chance. You can own a piece of my show. That's right, Dave's Gone By is ready to promote you. If you have a product, event, or service to hawk shamelessly, you can buy 30 or 60 seconds of advertising time on my show. You can even be a sponsor. Just imagine. This week's News Gone By is brought to you by you. We'll be right back after this word from your product. Advertising on Dave's Gone By is cost-effective and reaches listeners not only on Long Island, but thanks to WGBB.com all over the world. To get a piece of the Dave, call 516-295-1111. 1511 or email davesgoneby@aol.com. To see our disgustingly low ad rates, check our website, hometown.aol.com/davesgoneby. Remember, you could be talking to you right now. Are you listening? Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Hope you've been enjoying my chat with Neil Innes. I mean, we are just scratching the surface. We talked about the Bonzos and the Beatles. Haven't even gotten to Python and the Ruggles yet. So yes, there is much more Neil to come on future episodes of Dave's Gone By. I may play a little more next week, October 14th, although I already do have a guest for the next show, Pamela Scott. She's directing that play I told you about last week, Crimes of the Heart. They're doing a revival at the T. Schreiber Studio. That's on West 26th Street. Crimes of the Heart, of course, Beth Henley's Pulitzer-winning comedy about three kooky sisters gathering during a family crisis. You've probably seen the movie, but if you've never seen the play, it's a different experience, and my guess is they're doing a good production of it now through October 24th at T. Schreiber Studio, 7th Avenue and 26th Street in the city, 212-352-3101, 352-3101, and Pam Scott is my guest next week in the neighborhood. I'll ask her about Crimes of the Heart and why that remains such a popular and evergreen show, and about her career as an acting teacher. I always find it as interesting to talk to directors and drama teachers as I do the performers, since their perspective tends to be more broad and at the same time more specific and tangible. It is hard to explain, but we'll have Pam Scott here to try next Thursday on Dave's Gone By. For this Thursday's entertainment, I want to thank my sponsors, Total Theater and Performing Arts Insider. For more on that wonderful theater magazine, please go to TotalTheater.com. Subscriptions are available at a 10% discount to Dave's Gone By listeners. And mentioning this show also gets you 10% off at the delicious Quiznos of Hewlett. Soups and sandwiches and snacks, all tasty toasty, on Broadway in Hewlett. Across the street from Hewlett Minuteman Press for all your printing, copying, binding, poster-making, and pasta-shaking needs. Call 516-569-5577 to find out more. And there's more to listen to on WGBB than just me, believe it or not. For example, Long Island's Dating, advice for singles to start off the weekend with Bonnie D. Graham, Friday nights at 6. And then the Saturday Night Rock Block, 7:30 Saturdays, the Mr. Redman Music Show, with independent bands and brand new rock, followed by wild and off-the-wall zoo-style comedy with Mikey and Jimmy at 9. Sundays, of course, it's Your World, with my good pal Joe Salzone, conservative politics with a smile and an open mind. And Joe's going to be super busy this month because he's also got a couple of shows on Mondays between now and the elections. And the woman who can predict who will win? Well, not really, but she can do your horoscope sign and tell you nice things about your love life, Joyce Keller. Longest-running radio call-in psychic, Wednesday nights at 11. And Larry Davidson, hosting WGBB Tonight, Thursdays at 6, an hour before my show. And then The Instrumental Invasion, light jazz with Mike Shamari, new time, right after me, 8 o'clock, starting next week. Welcome to the Thursday lineup, Mike. And I want to wish congratulations to my old friend Jay. He and his wife Edna just had a baby girl. Mazel tov, mazel tov. And condolences to my friend Scott and his wife Tanya. Her mom passed away from lung cancer on Tuesday. Was not a surprise, but still, as Tom Waits put it, misery is the river of the world, everybody row. I want to thank engineer Tom Ross for his help and support. I want to thank my beloved wife, Joyce, for her love and support. And I thank you, the well-heeled listener, for your arch support. Just a reminder before we go, a few weeks back, I had another musical guest on the program, Dustin Ehrlich, an old friend from school days, who's now making his name as a jazz guitarist. In fact, there's an article about him in the October issue of 20th Century Guitar magazine. Now, you can get the mag at some of the bigger retailers like Barnes & Noble and Borders, Or you can order it from tcguitar.com, tcguitar.com, to read about our neighborhood friend, Dustin Ehrlich. And be sure to catch tonight's tremendously special guest, Neil Innes, while he's in town on his East Coast jaunt. Saturday night, he's at the Stephen Talkhouse in Amagansett, and Sunday, October 10th, at the B.B. King Blues Club on 42nd Street in Manhattan. We'll close with a little more Neil, a song called Down That Road from the Recollections 3 collection, and next Thursday will be the 97th episode of Dave's Gone By, which means number 100 is just a month away. Gonna be special, but I try to make every week special, so be here 7 days from now, 7 p.m., October 14th, for Pam Scott, Inside Broadway, and more me. Until then, don't miss your Days Gone By. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. Happy Simchas Torah from Mia to Yora, and Gone By.
As we're together.